Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Allison Bashford. She is the Scientia Professor of History and Director of the Laureate Center for History and Population at the University of New South Wales, Australia. And we're talking about her new book, Decoding the Hand, A History of Science, Medicine, and Magic. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you.
How did you personally go down the rabbit hole about hands? I mean, it's like the least expected thing I think of most people, but how did you do it? What attracted you to the hands?
Yes, well, your surprise in a way mirrors my own surprise that I've written a book on the hand. And so, you know, at one level, not that surprising for me, because my original work and many books later, many of them have been in the field of medical history.
Right.
And medical history is about the human body, and the hand is a pretty interesting part of the human body. You know, so at one level, it fits with the many other fields that I've been thinking through in terms of histories of medicine. But the story, if I can just indulge for a moment, the story that is a real surprise still to me how I got there. So my last book was on the Huxley dynasty of biologists and writers, including Aldous Huxley. And strangely, Aldous Huxley... Well, those who know him wouldn't think it strange. He quite liked palmistry. And just as a little side rabbit hole, exactly as you put it, I thought, oh, you know, where was he getting this done? And who was doing this for Aldous Huxley, the famous British author? And I found out that the papers of the woman who Aldous Huxley called his palmist were sitting in the wonderful Wellcome Library in the History of Medicine in London. So I just, on a side, you know, afternoon, nothing better to do, went in and looked at those papers. And I opened up the folders from the archive boxes. And it turns out that this so-called palmist was a highly educated, Berlin-educated medical doctor, a refugee from the Nazis living in London in the late 1930s, cleverer than most people you or I would know or talk to now, cleverer than most people in her circle. But she was taking palm readings. And so that was the first little moment where I thought, what's going on here? That a young...
And you're talking about Charlotte Wolfe, right?
That's right. That's her name.
She's one of the most fascinating people in this book. You should write an entire book about her.
Thank you for saying that. So the real moment that clinched it, I was looking at the prints of the palms that she was taking of Aldous Huxley and, you know, Nijinsky, the dancer, and Maurice Ravel, and all these interwar cultural luminaries. I mean, you couldn't think in the 1920s and 30s of a group more interesting. So all their palm prints were there. So that was interesting enough. I turned the next folder, and this was the real moment of lack of understanding, which was always the curiosity for me. There was the huge palm print of Mock, the lowland gorilla who was in London Zoo. Not only that, he'd been dead for 2 days, and the zookeeper had written to this Dr. Charlotte Wolfe and said, I know you want to take Mock's palm print and fingerprints and thumbprints, but it was always too dangerous. He's dead. He's in the morgue. If you come in the next 24 hours, you can take his palm print. And there it was before me, this huge, poignant, because I knew that the beast was dead, print of this gorilla's palm. And at that point, I thought, you know, after all these years, I know the period well, I know the people well, I can get into the minds of people in, you know, medical doctors in the 1930s. I had no idea why, for what reason, she was taking the print of this gorilla. And that was the moment where I thought, I've got to find this out.
And like I said, she's a fascinating person. When you said palmistry, though, her Charlotte Wolfe's idea of why she was looking at the hand is very different from the way sort of people maybe in the Renaissance would look at the hand. She was doing a medical procedure. She would consider what she was doing was a medical diagnosis.
Absolutely, and that you're kind of spot on there. What I try to do in this book is to gather up both the connections and the distinctions between, you know, kind of what most listeners would appreciate as traditional palmistry, but add to it this whole scientific and medical story to it. And so she's looking at the palm prints really very much as a scientist. She's looking at it, lines on the palms, through a whole discipline of primatology and evolutionary biology.
Wow.
You know, she would say that her intellectual forebears weren't a traditional palmist. In fact, they were anatomists, you know, famous anatomists like Charles Bell in the 1830s, who was, you know, one of Britain's most distinguished anatomists. She reads her way through Darwin and what he had to say about the difference between different kinds of primates, including humans and gorillas. And so she's looking at palm prints to some extent in that evolutionary biology tradition through plain anatomical traditions. And that, I've got to say, that's one of the moments that made me really sit up, because I just thought, oh, hang on a minute. Of course there's a tradition of palmistry, but on the other hand, the hand, no pun intended, creases in the hand, it's just plain old anatomy, you know.
And genetics.
And once I kind of went, exactly, and how are they inherited,
right.
What do they mean, that, and for me that connected it up to, in some ways, a much more straightforward medical tradition that, of course, has been interested in the hand, like all other parts of the human body.
In decoding the hand, it's an amazing history that you trace in all the different ways that people looked at the meaning of the hand, especially the palm, but also the other parts of the hand, too. And it starts out as a way of predicting who the person is. And that sort of carries right through to the end and to the 21st century. That people believed that what was going on internally was reflected externally, like on the surface of the hand, would tell you about the interior life of that person.
Exactly. Thank you for putting that so well. And in a way, once I cottoned on to this long, you know, we might think of it as one long, long history of how the bodily, all of our bodily surfaces, the skin, and in this case, the particular patterns on the hand, reflect or were understood to reflect in different systems of thinking. That's what I trace, what's going on internally. And over the centuries, the inside of humans, our very selves, are understood through very different, you know, ways of thinking. You know, in Isaac Newton's time, where I start the book, and even earlier, you know, our inside soul is this hugely important matter that is, of course, understood to be determined by God or gods or vast external forces. So that's a world in which, you know, our internal selves, you know, it's a world in which, kind of amazingly, our internal selves and what's written on our surface or engraven on our surface of our skins, they would say, is connected to vast gods, to celestial spheres, to stars, to the sun, to the moon. You know, these are hard things for us to grasp in the 21st century, but part of my job as a historian is to explain how they were almost ordinary things in the 14th, 15th, 16th century. You know, by the 18th century, there's this strong idea of character being readable on on our bodies, on our external surfaces. In the 19th century, a kind of a psychoanalytic idea just starts to emerge about personality. And I was just so stunned to go back to this wonderful Berlin doctor, Charlotte Wolff. She's very closely linked to Jung. And at some point, she writes articles published in very high-quality scientific journals about how, she says, I can see the id and the ego in the palm of the hand.
Right.
So that's the internal that she's seeing written on the body. You know, and that kind of moves forward. And at the end of the book, to kind of pull the whole, to give people an arc of the whole book, you know, although this sounds curious and strange or outlandish or even just incorrect, you know, in some way, you know, and that's absolutely true, in some ways it's not that different to the way in which now there's vast industries and, more importantly, desire on the part of people to send a part of their inside selves, that is to say the swab cheek, the DNA swab from their internal cheeks or wherever, their hair, off to Ancestry DNA or whoever, precisely to get information, you know, secret information, so to say, that's disclosed to them about their familial deep past, but also their future medical prognostics. So we might mock all of these ideas about what you can read from the body about the past or the future, but in a way, I learned to mock, you know, we're mocking at our peril because in so many ways, we do many of the same things.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Alison Bashford. She is the Scientia Professor of History and Director of the Laureate Center for History and Population at the University of New South Wales, Australia. And we've been talking about her new book. It's really a fascinating social and medical history. Decoding the Hand, A History of Science, Medicine, and Magic. Alison, it was fascinating for me to read in the very beginning where all the traditions of reading significance in the lines of the palm came from, because it ends up coming from several sources: Sanskrit, medieval Hebrew, the Kabbalah, Arabic, Latin books. All of that was sort of brought together to create that whole mystical tradition.
Yes, it's very interesting, isn't it? It's in some ways, you know, very. We think about centuries in Indo-Europe, like a very expansive Europe that really incorporates a lot of, in early centuries, you know, it incorporates a lot of Arabic knowledge. It links over to then Persia. It brings in Sanskrit ideas. This is a world where, you know, the world of, let's call it Christendom, in the early modern and late medieval period, really is a world shaped very expansively. You know, we think of it as limited, but it's not.
Right.
And so by the time you get to, I'm going to put a point on this, by the time you get to someone like Isaac Newton in the 17th century, who we think of as what he was, you know, a really, really preeminent physicist and astronomer. In fact, he is a beneficiary of centuries of discussion about this question of how do planets link to human bodies? And that comes through Sanskrit traditions, definitely through Arabic traditions, that get amalgamated into the Latin and then Christendom world that he is a late inhabitant of. To me, the most amazing element of all of this that came as a total surprise was the significance of very, very ancient Hebrew texts, and as you say, Kabbalah, and how strongly that made its way into European texts. That is this very, very learned tradition, very learned occult tradition.
But I have to ask you, Alison, during the medieval Christendom period, wasn't any kind of divining fraught with all sorts of problems, religious problems, just by the fact that you're divining something?
Yeah, so interesting. So, you know, everybody can understand, I'm sure, just what a deeply theologically learned and worried world this was. And that in many traditions, you know, many, many religious traditions, I mean. In the Christian tradition, you're absolutely right that there's a great not just suspicion, but a theology that says that certain kinds of divining of the future is only the domain of God.
Right.
So when humans try and divine the future, this is not just suspicious, this is sinful and, some argue, diabolical. It's the work of Satan, because you're encroaching on what is God's privilege, right? So this lifts the, you know, for me as a historian, this just lifts the whole field of something like palmistry, or as it was then called, chiromancy,
right,
into this really, really learned, complicated theological world. And over time, it was argued, divining from the body was argued away into what was called, essentially a natural divining, not an artificial divining, because God put these words, put these marks on the human body
for us to read.
No human intervention needed to read it, and that made it unlike something like, you know, that world was just a world in which the future was tried to be divined in 100 different ways, and they're all weird and fascinating. One of them, stranger than anything, was divining the future from the shoulder blade of a sheep's
skeleton. Well, that goes back to ancient times.
Absolutely ancient. And that, for example, was understood to be an illegitimate way of divining the future, because too much human intervention was needed. And so there's all these very clever theologians who are kind of separating out and making divining the future and internal character from the human body okay. And so that's why there's these extraordinary early kind of 10th, 11th century Christian documents in which clerics and priests are writing down what is to be learned from the hand. But they borrow very strongly from an even older, especially Hebrew tradition of doing just that.
Your book is populated by all sorts of fascinating people. And some I knew because I was a student of the history of alchemy and read a lot about that. Paracelsus, Theophrastus von Hohenheim. He wrote this Chiromantia book. There are all sorts of other people like Saunders, but we're going to run out of time. We can't talk. We're only going to scratch the surface of this book. There's a whole other history about the traditions of the Romani, the gypsies, sometimes called the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of brought fortune telling and palmistry back to like sort of the old idea of just reading palms, whereas other people were bringing all sorts of Kabbalistic traditions into it. They brought back this whole other thing, and they came from India.
That's right. And so I track in a chapter on this in the book how Roma, now called Roma Sintian,
right,
traveler communities, in Anglophone traditions anyway, arrived in Tudor England. This is the case that I look at. And they were understood at that time. They were called Egyptians. They were understood to come from Egypt, which is where the term gypsy comes from. Much later, it's clear that, in fact, they come into Europe, into the German lands originally from, you know, then Persia, from North India. And they brought with them, it's now understood, a very ancient Sanskrit and North India, especially North Indian traditions, very high learned and written traditions that still exist, of course, across South Asia and India, of reading the hand. And so they come into Europe. They come into the British Isles, but their practice of divining the future, and also taking money, it's understood to be illegitimately in exchange for telling people's fortunes.
Well, I want to stop you there, because people weren't there. It was at a time, including in the late 19th century, the early 19th century, there were gypsy lore societies. There were people who are scholars of so, and again, I use the word gypsy because that's what they used at the time. People were fascinated. It leaked all the way into writers. So you find lore in books like Jane Eyre and stuff like that. But they made
That's
a distinction
right.
between learned, quote unquote, chiromancy and, quote, gypsy pretended chiromancy. So because they were accepting money for it, it was degraded.
And also because it's not a written tradition.
So
who set up things like the Gypsy Law Society, LORE,
yeah,
they're then called folklorists. They're people who are most right. fascinated with the people of the world who have no written tradition, whose culture and practices and LORE law are passed down verbally. And so that's why a lot of people who wanted, like later Charlotte Wolfe, this Berlin-trained doctor, she's bending over backwards to separate herself out from right. the so-called gypsy tradition, precisely because she says she inherits not the written tradition, which is high learning, which is incredibly complicated, which makes its way in a scientific tradition, you know, into psychoanalysis and anatomy and so forth. And so the so-called gypsies, or the Egyptians, as they were called first, are both of interest to certain people, but understood to be carrying forward not that learned tradition, but a folk tradition. And that kind of separation carries all the way through the centuries.
But as you write in the book, towards the end of the 19th century, or the last half of it, there was a resurgence of sort of occultism. And that's when you have figures like Eliphas Levi and Madame Blavatsky, yeah. who people yeah. may not remember Madame Blavatsky, but she was the one that sort of originated spiritualism.
Yes, theosophies, a very particular version of spiritualism. And that's exactly right. And so for them, you know, they're, again, weird. They are weird. But I learned as a historian to stop just thinking of them as strange, and certainly to stop kind of feeling that I'm somehow superior to them because I know what's right and wrong and what's true and false, and actually to stop and take them seriously. And then it's completely different to saying they were correct, you know. But that late 19th century so-called occult revival is so interesting, and
oh, yeah.
a medical historian and someone interested in the body, they're putting forward really interesting ways in which we can understand that interior self that you started to
right.
talk about earlier, the body, the future, the past, what's knowable, how we can. It's kind of, they also take on an evolutionary idea that humans in their period, let's say the 1860s to 1920s is a kind of a high point for all this, how certain current humans in the present, notably themselves, were kind of heralding another advance of humankind that was part spirit, part bodily, but moving forward into another way of knowing and being altogether. How fascinating is that? And so for them, what's written on the hand or engraven in the palms, or how the interior self manifests on the surface, was super interesting. And they, you know, as a historian, I can't remember when I didn't know about this 19th century occult revival, but I stopped in my tracks at one point researching all of this, and I thought, oh, all along I've known about this occult revival. I don't really know what they were reviving.
Yeah.
And it turns out that in the 19th century, they're reviving that Kabbalah, for a start. They're reviving the Hebrew tradition. They're reviving the Christianizing of that tradition. They're reviving a whole lot of much earlier Renaissance texts for the 19th century, spiritually interested, theosophically interested, present, and ways of reading character, internal self, and the future, and the past for that matter, in and around the hand was deeply interesting for them.
We're almost completely out of time. We're down to a couple of minutes. But we didn't get to the medical tradition that I think it's pronounced dermatoglyphics, which was sort of
a
psychoanalytical analysis of the hand. We talked about it earlier in the show. Some of the people in that, though, got sidetracked and started to write about things like race in a not a very constructive way. But that's a whole part of its history. But Charlotte Wolfe, for me, at the end of the book, she remains the person that I most want to read an entire book about.
Oh.
She was just so fascinating. And like I said, there's so many interesting people that go in and out of this book. My guest tonight has been Alison Bashford. She is the Scientia Professor of History and Director of the Laureate Center for History and Population at the University of New South Wales, Australia. And we've been talking about her new book. We just barely touched on a few topics in it. It's an amazing history. Decoding the Hand, A History of Science, Medicine, and Magic. And I want to mention, there's a number of wild palm illustrations in this book. You'll end up taking a magnifying glass to read all the details that are written on the palm. It's an amazing book. Alison, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for your enthusiasm for the book. Much appreciated.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.